I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Elise Lufkin. She is author of the new book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission, and she will be speaking tomorrow evening at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you. This is a similar format to the last book that we talked about several years ago, which was about rescued dogs getting second chances. So it's written by the dog owners themselves, who in this case are people who have found or rescued dogs in some way, and those dogs have come, and one cat, have come to be helper dogs or therapy dogs of some kind. How did you come across the subject and all of these stories?
Well, the subject developed naturally really from the other books. My first two books were, as you said, stories about rescued dogs, concentrating more or less on the way that they enhance the life of the rescuer, because I'm very, very interested in the idea that an animal that's considered a disposable, like an old Kleenex, and just tossed away by somebody can go on, and if he's given a second chance by someone else, can go on to really, you know, give back so much and add so much to that person's life. And then this last book just took it a step further. I had, in the other books, we had touched on service dogs and therapy dogs and, you know, dogs that worked with people in wheelchairs. There's a seizure alert dog in one of the books, and one of Second Chances, I think, has a story about a dog that alerted when his owner had angina attacks. And so I was very, very interested in that idea that people not only will rescue an animal, and it's a lot of work, you know, basically some more than others, but some of them need considerable amount of time and attention and obedience training and reassuring before they really are comfortable sharing a person's life. And, you know, you have all the medical issues, if there are any. You have feeding and taking, you know, general care. But these people have taken that, and I think very often by the time you get a dog to the point where he's comfortable in your life and you're happy to have him there, you really feel you're happy to relax and enjoy that dog. And these people do relax and enjoy their dog, certainly, but they've elected to take the whole thing a step further, where they've done further training with their dogs, whether it be for just general obedience in order to be able to take them to hospitals or nursing homes or places like that, or whether it's to train them in search and rescue, or whether it's to train dogs to, you know, to work for someone with a disability. I have some hearing dogs and dogs that work with people in wheelchairs and things like that. And it just seemed to me such an extra generous gift that these people have been willing to give, not only to the dog, but also to the world, or not to the world, I mean, that's much too grandiose, but to people, whether they're being visited in the hospital or whether they're getting a service dog, which can change their lives.
It really amazes me how people are able to adopt a dog that is really, you know, you might call it a bad dog or a terribly sick dog, and work with that dog to rehabilitate it to the point where it's a normal, happy dog. It really takes a special, I mean, I was trying to imagine myself doing that, although I've certainly adopted some sick dogs, but people really go the extra mile for these dogs who they didn't even know two days earlier.
And it's been one of the most exciting things about writing these books, is to see that just tremendous generosity of spirit, because I think we all get bombarded with so many stories of cruelty and of neglect and abuse and all the terrible things that are going on in the world, but it's just so reassuring to know that at the same time there are these wonderful, generous, kind people who are, you know, really doing a lot. And then, of course, it's not just a question of training your dog to be able to take him to a hospital, but then you have to actually go to the hospital. And so people, you know, are adding big chunks of time into their weekly schedule to go and visit with the dog, or go and do search and rescue work or training with the dog or things like that. Then that's on an ongoing basis. There's a woman in To the Rescue, Billy Peters, who's in her 80s, I think her mid-80s even, and Billy rescues racing greyhounds, and she takes those dogs 3 or 4 days a week. She takes one of them to, in one case, and one goes to a nursing home, one goes to a reading program at a library, one goes to a veteran's home. She has other, you know, places that like her to come and visit, and she's out and about and, you know, doing things, reaching out to people and helping people and taking her dogs out to comfort people every week.
Tell us the story about the person who adopted a deaf dog that then went on to work with deaf children.
Oh, yes. Cooper is a dog. That he's a Labrador, and he came, he was abandoned. I can't remember how he was abandoned, but he ended up in a Labrador rescue, with a Labrador rescue group in Texas, and he just bounced from foster home to foster home, and everyone said he was perfectly sweet, but he just was just so difficult to train that he just seemed to tune you out, not to pay any attention, just very, very difficult. And then, lo and behold, on about the third home, they discovered that he was absolutely stone deaf and really couldn't understand what people were saying to him, and there was no way to have expected that he would be able to know what sit means unless you gave him a hand signal or showed him or something. And he ended up being fostered by a woman who is a teacher for deaf children, and she fostered him and was going to just keep him, of course, for a little while and teach him, train him on hand signals and get him started. And then, of course, she fell in love with him, and so she ended up keeping him. And she takes him now with her to the classroom when she works with these deaf students. And she has taught him American Sign Language. And the children just get a huge kick out of practicing American Sign Language on him. And one little girl that he visited said, "I love Cooper because he's so sweet and because he's deaf like me." So and the dog just goes along and seems perfectly happy, which I think is another thing that you see often with dogs that visit people in hospitals, too, that if you have a dog with a disability, that the dog is usually quite happy and goes along with his life. And it's an inspiration to people that he visits who say, "Oh, well, you know, if Linus can get along on three legs, maybe I can work with whatever disability I have."
Right. And I learned from that how important it is when you have a deaf dog that the dog always has a member of the pack in sight. So when that dog was crated out of the room away from its owner, it went bananas. But as long as he could see its owner or at the very least see another dog or a person, then the dog was okay, because that's how he communicated with the rest of the world, was visually.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the person who adopted him said that he just went crazy, as you say, but she said she suddenly realized that it was as if you had taken someone and put them in solitary confinement, because he didn't know what was going on in the house. He didn't know where anybody was, and so she always had a rule that when she first fostered a dog, that it would stay in the laundry and be somewhat quarantined from the rest of the family, but she realized with this dog that she couldn't do that, so she moved the crate right into the, I can't remember, her living room or her bedroom, but somewhere where he would be able to see everybody and everything that was going on, so that even if she wasn't at home, he could see the other dogs. And he was completely reassured by that, and it made a huge difference. It's just part of that thing, I think, about communicating with animals, that you really have to make an effort to try to see the world the way they are seeing it, not the way you might necessarily think it would be.
There was a dog named Mandy that was a little, I think it was a Cocker Spaniel, that was adopted by a woman who ended up working with kids with this little dog. And one of the things that was striking, and I think this happens a lot, is people adopt dogs who are just like them. She said, I'm going to read it. She said, "Mandy and I are kindred spirits. I was almost made a ward of the court when I was 15. but with a chip on my shoulder, after abuse by multiple family members, I ran away from home instead. No one admitted the abuse till years later. Meanwhile, the dog had repeatedly been rejected and returned to the shelter, and no one had taken the time to understand the dog. And she and that dog got along perfectly. And when you look at the portrait, every one of these stories has a portrait with the dog. They look exactly alike.
I know, it's very funny. It's a very pretty blonde, woman, and
right.
A sweet blonde Cocker Spaniel with a big smile on
with
the
same exact facial expression.
And the Cocker Spaniel actually has a pink tutu on. I'm not sure you can see it in the photograph.
Oh, my goodness.
She dances. She goes to a school for developmentally disabled children, and she dances for them.
Amazing. We're talking to Elise Lufkin about the new book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission. Now, some dogs in the book are search and rescue dogs or dogs with a real job. One of them is a cadaver-finding dog working with an FBI agent, and there are some others. Tell us about some of these dogs.
Yes. Bailey, the cadaver dog, works for someone who was actually working at the Pentagon on September 11th, and she just had gone off her shift when the plane struck the building. But she, in the meantime, had this beautiful golden retriever who had been a sadly neglected dog, and she managed to adopt him, and she had trained him in search and rescue. She had another dog, worked in search and rescue. And she took both those dogs and searched at the Pentagon. And it's a tremendously important work, cadaver search, because it really helps the families of the people who are lost with some kind of closure. I mean, it's very sad work, but it's such an important part. And Eileen Romer, the FBI special agent, said that she had seen in her work, she did a lot of work with cases of abducted children. And she said she saw very, very clearly in that work how important it was that even if the worst happened and the child was not recovered alive, that at least for the family to know that the child had been found and to have some kind of closure was really very, very, very important. And this dog, and of course to a dog, it's all in a day's work. A dog doesn't really care, I don't think. I don't know. Anyway, a dog mostly is interested in the game of searching and whether he's looking for marijuana or cocaine or bombs or bed bugs. I have some bed bug dogs in the book. It's a game, and you get a reward, whether it's praise, food. Often it's a game. It'll be a tug of war or a ball or a toy or some favorite toy, something like that. And it's all part of a game, and that really was the way that dog worked. And then there are a couple of other, there's a pair of avalanche dogs that I talk about in the book also that do very much the same kind of work. The only thing there is they are trained to work in the snow and to dig and, you know, all that kind of thing.
When you read the book, you think about how just like some of us are temperamentally suited to certain jobs and not others, it's the same with dogs. And they have to be tested along all kinds of criteria to see whether they can even go into some of these job programs.
Absolutely. And there's a wonderful woman in Florida who has really made it's not her actual work, she's a psychologist, but in her hobby really is going to animal shelters and the people in the shelters near her around, I think she's around Tampa somewhere, actually look for dogs that might be suited for her. And she works very closely with a man in Texas who trains dogs for all sorts of detection, bomb detection and things like that. And it's one of the things that they look for is a very high play response, a very strong ball motivation. So sometimes it's the kind of thing that may have driven the original owner crazy. You know how some dogs are just so fixed on balls that they'll just drop the ball at your foot 8 million times in the day. And
right.
That's what they look for because that's so, so helpful in training the dog. And she has saved a lot of dogs that way. She also looks for dogs that are potential service dogs to work with people in wheelchairs and people like that. There is a dog, Sunny, in this book who works with a woman who has a bone disease and has never really grown. She's about 30 inches tall, and she's 24 years old. She's a pharmacist student. And this dog was found in a shelter. Or no, he was found by the side of the road, actually, but he turned out to look as if he was going to be a good kind of companion dog. And so Natalie has found literally hundreds of dogs that have then gone on and been placed with either as service dogs or as some kind of working dog that has worked in with the police or with, you know, there's an arson detection dog in the book. And she really, you know, just goes, that's what she does. And the ones that don't make it, that she usually takes them for a few weeks and figures out which way is the best way for them to go. But the ones that don't actually make the grade to go to Texas or to go on to a place that trains service dogs, she almost always finds homes for them, because usually by the time they've spent a few weeks with her, they've learned a lot of manners, and right. She's figured out what makes them tick, and they're adoptable suddenly.
It also goes to show that so many dogs really want a job. Some of them are happy to follow you around and be couch potatoes and stuff and just take their daily walk, but many of them, I know I've got two terriers that I know they love me, but they would be much happier if I were ranching rather than reading all day. But anyway, look, what about the therapy dogs who go to hospitals? What are the criteria? What do people look for in them as temperamental abilities?
Usually, one of the first steps, I mean, what you would look for is a dog that's comfortable with strangers and, you know, is fairly calm. Usually, they will have passed a canine good citizen test, which basically means that they can, you know, that they can walk on a leash, that they can approach a person, or they can approach a person with a dog, and they can sit quietly and wait until they're asked to move forward, that they can sit and lie down and come when they're called. And I mean, they'll always be on a leash when they're at work, but it's very important, one, that they're calm around people, two, that they're calm around other dogs, and three, that they're pretty obedient. And then usually, for instance, the Delta Society, which is one of the certifying groups, they often will have training sessions that you can sign up for, and then you do a certain amount of time, you know, working on things that the dog will help the dog to pass the certification test. And also they train, and all the good organizations also spend quite a lot of time and effort on training the person, training the handler, talking about, you know, ways to talk to people, the importance of not getting involved in the politics of the nursing home, or, you know, just sort of basic things and ways to approach people. And then, of course, there's so many different situations, and dogs are certified usually at different levels. For instance, my old terrier was certified at a fairly low level. She was fine. She was great for nursing homes, and she did it and loved it, and they loved her. She would not have been good. Much more demanding is anything that involves small children, because they're so unpredictable and so much in perpetual motion. And some dogs, you know, do very well with that. They're fine, but a facility with children, your dog would have to have a more complex rating than a dog that could go, say, to a nursing home or to a hospital where everything was fairly straightforward.
There are some dogs that just take to their therapeutic role instantaneously, and they know just what to do and who to talk to and who to lick and whose bed to sit by in a way that seems almost uncanny.
It is, but I think that dogs, having lived with people for so long, are very tuned in to people. And I think that dogs work very much from body language and facial expressions and nonverbal cues. So I think that they are tuned in. And I mean, it's one of the things that the handlers say over and over again, that their dog just really surprises them sometimes with his sensitivity in terms of knowing what's required. It's very interesting. I can read you the part about Dixon, I think.
Yes, Dixon, this little dachshund. Yes, please do.
Dixon the dachshund, who started out actually with having had the first, I don't know how many years, first 7 years of his life, he lived with someone who had no time for him, and he was just left alone all the time. And when Karen Kirchner adopted him, he just really wasn't very interested in people or hadn't met other dogs, wasn't used to other dogs. And she worked with him for a long time. I think she went through three complete sessions in dog school. She said it was about their 23rd class before he started to figure out that she was telling him something, that if he responded that treats were involved, and that he really made that connection. But then he went on and finally got certified and did a lot of hospital visiting at Cedars-Sinai and also at the Henry Mayo Memorial Hospital, I think, in Santa Clarita. And anyway, one of the stories that Karen told me was about a Saturday afternoon. I'll read this to you. Dixon and I, and I'm speaking in Karen's voice, because all these stories are narrated in the voice of the person who has the dog. On a Saturday afternoon, Dixon and I went to the room of a young man I'll call Peter, who had requested a therapy dog. When Peter first saw Dixon, he seemed disappointed. He had wanted a bigger, fluffier dog. I offered to leave and get him signed up for the type of dog he preferred, but he decided that Dixon would do in a pinch. When I put Dixon on the bed, Peter complained that he wasn't effervescent enough. Again, I offered to leave and look for someone else. And again, Peter said Dixon would do. At that point, Peter's visitor asked if I would mind staying in the room while he went to get a quick cup of coffee. After his friend left the room, Peter began to hallucinate and started to call Dixon Rusty. I learned later that Rusty was Peter's childhood dog, a golden retriever. Peter said, "Rusty, I've missed you. Come to me, Rusty." Tears were streaming down his face. Then Dixon did something I have never seen him do. He wriggled up Peter's side and buried his muzzle in Peter's armpit. The tears continued, but a smile appeared as well. "Rusty, you haven't forgotten. I love you, boy." Dixon started moving his muzzle around, tickling Peter. Peter let out loud, racking sobs mingled somehow with joy. "Rusty, you know what I like." When Peter's visitor returned, Dixon and I left to visit our other patients. I could hear Peter talking to his memory of Rusty as we walked down the hallway. After we completed our visits, I decided to return to Peter's room. He was gone, his bed stripped. A nurse told me that Peter had passed away a few minutes after Dixon and I left. It's the sadness of seeing someone so young reach the end of his life broke my heart, but I knew that Dixon had helped Peter feel that he was leaving this world with his beloved Rusty at his side. So that's certainly an example, I think, of what you were talking about.
Yeah, Mary, amazing, Carla,
in
amazing.
In terms of a dog really sensing what will be helpful.
The very next story in the book is equally moving, and I mean, I get choked up just thinking about it, about a dog named Ceres who ended up working with children who were terribly abused, who had parents who were drug addicts and things like that. And this dog could do, and a lot of dogs, it turns out, can do things that the most compassionate teachers and counselors are unable to do, which is give them a sense of self-esteem.
I think that's absolutely true. And Ceres had a very rough start. He was an abandoned dog, and he was adopted by a woman who loved him and worked with him. And then she started taking him to the Valley of the Moon Children's Center working with abandoned, abused, and neglected children. And in the end, as you say, six-year-old Joey, this is one story of many with the work that Ceres did with these children. Six-year-old Joey did not feel very good about himself. Like many children, he thought that he had been sent to the children's center because he was a bad boy. He ignored the teacher's attempts to reassure him. After his first class with Ceres and me, Joey wanted to pet Ceres. So another student volunteered to tell him about the three rules for proper and polite dog greeting. After Joey first asked permission of the owner, me, he then asked permission of the dog by letting Ceres sniff his hand until Ceres stopped sniffing. And then third, Joey knelt by Ceres' side to pet him on the chest and neck. Ceres began to cover Joey's face and hands with kisses, something the dog had never done before. I said, "Joey, Ceres loves you so much, you must be a very good boy." "No," said Joey, "I am not a good boy. I'm not good." I replied, "You are a good boy, Joey. Ceres knows, and he doesn't make mistakes about important things like that." But Joey couldn't believe me, so he said, "Can we ask Ceres?" Now, all the children know that Ceres can answer questions. One bark for no, two barks for yes, and three barks for maybe. Ceres has never once disappointed me by giving an inappropriate answer to any question from a child, and he refuses to answer private or mean questions. He is very good at reading body language and even thoughts and feelings, so I was not worried that he might give the wrong answer to this critical question. It makes me nervous just to hear about it.
I know.
To go on with the story, we asked Ceres, "Is Joey a really good boy?" And Ceres spoke up with a loud and clear voice, "Bark, bark." That means yes. There was no mistaking what he said and how loudly he said it. Little Joey stood up tall and straight and swaggered off, saying, "If Siri says it's so, it must be true." I gathered up my dog supplies and left the room, choking back some tears. I saw a little boy's faith in himself restored by a brave therapy dog who had once been abandoned and abused, just like his friend Joey.
The book is called To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission by Elise Lufkin, and photographs by Diana Walker. We've just got a minute or two left. Tell us about how all these portraits of the dogs were taken. And it really is striking. I mean, they really are portraits of the dogs and not of the dog owners.
That's true. And often they're portraits, I think, of the dog's work. That's right. Really what Diana was trying to do. Diana, for many years, was Time Magazine's photographer at the White House. So she's had many, many years of photographing presidents. And when I started the dog books, I asked her if she'd be interested in working on this project. And she has done photographs for all three of the books. And they really are wonderful, wonderful portraits. And they just explain the stories in a great way. And we had a lot of fun traveling around and figuring out what stories could, what pictures could help tell the story.
Elise Lufkin will be talking about her book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Elise, thank you so much for this wonderful book and for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. May I just add quickly that the book signing will benefit the Santa Fe Humane Society and also Assistance Dogs of the West. A portion of book sales will be donated by the bookstore to those organizations.
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And thanks to the wonderful Dorothy Massey and her daughter Mary for making that possible as well.
Yes, wonderful.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.